Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. In the year 1922, the golden age of archaeology was in full swing. In late fall, an unlikely duo of explorers combined their efforts to make what many consider to be the greatest discovery in world history. Since their great find, Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon changed the face of archaeology and shed new light on a figure that, without their efforts, would have been lost to history forever. On this episode, we discuss King Tut's tomb. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 2 of the series, we're discussing the great empires of the ancient world, the forces that created and destroyed them, and the lasting legacies they leave behind that help shape our modern age. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, WartimePodcast.com. For the last several episodes, we've been discussing the world of ancient Egypt, that land of mystery and intrigue that has captivated our Western civilization for generations. We've talked about the key figures and events that changed its history and cemented its legacy as one of the most advanced civilizations of the ancient world. Today, however, we're going to be switching gears a bit, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the history of history in pursuit of understanding one of the most universally recognized figures in the history of the Egyptian world, King Tutankhamun, the boy king, more popularly known as King Tut. This is a rare opportunity for me as a historian today, because normally we're so wrapped up of the task at hand that we very rarely get to talk shop, and that's exactly what we're going to do. One of my real pleasures, and something I think is so fascinating in this field, is not talking about the details and singularities of a specific topic, but talking about how historians and archaeologists deal with that topic. Today we're going to talk about ancient Egypt. There's no doubt we're going to be transferred to the year 1333 BCE, but we're going to do it from the modern perspective. We're going to learn about the life of Tutankhamun, the way we discovered the details of that life. This is a very unusual and unique opportunity for us here on Wartime, and I'm very excited that you can join me in the process. Tutankhamun, without question, has what we would think of as universal name recognition, if not in the fullest sense, then just by his popular nickname, King Tut. You can ask anyone in the Western world to name one figure from the world of ancient Egypt, to name one person who helped shape the Egyptian world. And from college graduates to school children, they're all going to give you the same name, and that name is King Tut. The question we have next is, and I challenge you to engage in this exercise, is ask them, what do you know about him, and why do you know his name? Why do you know his name? It's a simple question. It's a basic question. But I can almost guarantee you that they won't have a sufficient answer for you. And that's something that, again, is just an exercise to see exactly where we all stand in the history of the ancient world and how much we have to learn. You could even ask other historians that, and they probably couldn't give you the great details that you're looking for. It's all part of the challenge, and it's all part of the fun of a figure like the boy king Tutankhamun. So let's talk a little bit about him. Let's talk about where he comes from, how we know about him, and more importantly, perhaps, what we still don't know and what we probably will never know. Now, this is a story that does not begin in Egypt. It does not begin in the Nile River Valley. It doesn't even begin in the ancient period. This begins in the 19th century in, of all places, Great Britain. If you go to London today, and you drive about 70 miles out of the city, you're going to very quickly see a very recognizable, particularly today, and very lavish country house. Some would call it a castle. It'd be known as Highclere Castle. And Highclere Castle is where the story of King Tutankhamun begins. Probably not where you're expecting, but this is the fun of this episode. In that castle, in, say, 1890, 1900, you're going to find a man named George Herbert. Now, who is George Herbert? Probably a good question. George Herbert goes by the landed gentry name of Lord Carnarvon. Now, who is Lord Carnarvon? Well, there have been many Lord Carnarvons before George Herbert, and there's many after. There's still one today. But he's a member of England's landed elite. He lives in Highclere Castle and inherited a fortune, and so would his next in line and next in line until modern day. Now, George Herbert is a bit of an adventurer, and in that regard, he's not indifferent from a lot of the other members of the British aristocracy. Yes, he enjoys fine things. Yes, he enjoys spending money. But if you're talking about George Herbert, a guy who at times can get himself into some financial trouble, a man who at times is not focused on the things that an English lord is probably expected to be focused on, you're talking about a man who desires adventure. He is something we can say maybe of a thrill seeker. Now, he's not jumping out of airplanes, but he does take a lot of risks that men his age, and particularly of his stature, don't normally take. George Herbert is well known for being a real speed demon. When the automobile, the gasoline-powered automobile, is first invented, he speeds throughout the lands on his estate, and he actually has a bit of a crash in 1901. Now, his body, and with medicine not being what it is today, is really, really wrecked after that crash, and he becomes a very brittle, very frail man. He has a severe immune deficiency. He becomes sick very easily. He has a lot of illnesses that he should have, at his age, been able to shake off. The car accident kind of brought these to the forefront. So it's his pursuit of these thrills that put his body in a compromised position. And again, George Herbert not doing things a member of the landed elite really should be doing. When you inherit that kind of wealth, you are a steward of the wealth. That's what the landed aristocracy in Britain would always say. I'm a steward of this wealth. I want to leave my estate for the next Lord Carnarvon in a better place than it was when I received it. Well, he's not exactly living up to his end of the bargain. But Lord Carnarvon, because of his ailing health, will be told to move to warmer climates, get out of the soggy, rainy sort of environment of England, and move somewhere warmer where you can recover. Again, remember, this is the height of the British Empire. There are a lot of very exotic, very warm, very dry places he could have moved. And the place he'll move is where else but Egypt. Remember, Egypt is politically controlled through a number of different channels at the height of the British Empire, by the British themselves. So Egypt was a very attractive option for a thrill seeker like Lord Carnarvon. But when he goes there, he absolutely falls in love with ancient Egypt for the same reason that we still do today. The magic of it, the mystery of it, the fact that there's a lot of things to learn and there's a lot of things still to be discovered. And who knows how much that you'll never know. So Lord Carnarvon will begin to use his personal fortune to discover the great untold riches of the ancient Egyptian world archaeologically that still needed to be found. On his own, he satisfies, I think, his desires. But as far as actually pulling things out of the ground, Lord Carnarvon is disenchanted. And he's disenchanted because so far the one thing he's found, the one thing he has to show for the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars spent exploring this land, is one mummified cat. That's the extent of it. A mummified feline, not uncommon in the ancient Egyptian world, but not exactly a game changer. So now what do we have, just as a review, just as a setup? You have a very wealthy man, anxious to explore this world from the British Empire. He's got an almost unchecked amount of wealth, one he would squander, and he's now interested in exploring a still undiscovered Egyptian world. If you go to Egypt today, they always like to say the great discoveries have already been made. Well, that's not entirely true, but it's certainly not as lucrative as it would have been in Carnarvon's time. When you're talking about the late 19th century, the early 20th century, you're really seeing a golden age of archaeology in the ancient Near East. Places like Israel, places like Egypt, places like Syria and Jordan, there are still untold discoveries to be made. Carnarvon knows that, and he wants a part of that action. But the question is, how's he going to get it? He's proven on his own he's having almost no effect. Again, he finds one mummified feline. But he knows that there's still a lot out there to be found. The reality is he lacks the training, he lacks the experience, he lacks the grittiness, really, that it takes to be a field archaeologist. Rudyard Kipling, the famed author, said in about the time of Lord Carnarvon that the field archaeologist combines all of the social standing as a learned man of the world with all of the adventure of a gold prospector. And that's something I think that was very attractive to Carnarvon, but he's still faced with a dilemma. He's not going to have much luck, but someone out there can, and who's that someone going to be? Enter Howard Carter. If you ask any archaeologist who the most famous man of his field was in the golden age of the field, Howard Carter would probably be on a very short list of contenders, because he will make his name, even though he makes dozens and dozens and dozens of finds before meeting Carnarvon, as the man to find King Tut's tomb. And that's a much bigger story we're going to work our way through. But early on, Howard Carter is the man Carnarvon's looking for. Now, Howard Carter's an interesting archaeological figure himself. He's got no traditional archaeological training. That is, he's never went to school for archaeology. But the life he's led puts him in as good a position as anyone to lead what we would think of as an archaeological expedition at the time. Carter had worked in Egypt for about 31 years total before his greatest discovery, and he had been in Egypt since the age of 17. Now, why does he go there? Well, it's not because he has this gifted talent for understanding the ancient world. It's because he has a very real affinity for drawing. Drawing. It's his artistic ability that gets him there. And he's brought to Egypt because every discovery you make, every tomb you find, the walls are littered with beautiful, illuminated carvings and sculptures. And it was his abilities to copy these remnants in such great detail that really brought Howard Carter there. But it was really only the beginning. He couldn't help but fall in love with the ancient Egyptian world as he worked his way through these tombs. And by 1899, Carter was appointed the Inspector General of Monuments in all of Upper Egypt. In 1905, he resigned from that position, and 2 years later, in 1907, he went to work for Lord Carnarvon. Now, what does that mean for us? Well, here are a story of two different men from very different backgrounds. Howard Carter was not from a wealthy family. Lord Carnarvon was born into untold wealth, wealth that most of us will never know in this world. But they both had the same driving passion, and they each sort of began from different places. Carnarvon was a thrill seeker. Carter himself had this deep thirst for knowledge. It was the ambience of ancient Egypt. It was the characteristics that still draw us in of that mysterious land that brought these two men together and took them to the Valley of the Kings. Whenever we look at ancient Egypt in the New Kingdom, some basic reference points we have to understand the story. You're not talking about a time period of building big, elaborate, enormous pyramids. I think we pretty well have covered that in previous episodes. But Egypt in the New Kingdom is still a world of great power and still a world of great prosperity. But cultural values have changed. Pyramids are very old kingdom for them. That's not necessarily something they're interested in anymore. Now, they're still obsessed with the afterlife. They're still obsessed with taking their power and prestige into the afterlife with them. And they're still obsessed with building lavish and expensive tombs. But the pyramid is out. By the time we get to the new kingdom, a new style of burial has taken place. Not a large, ostentatious, impressive above-ground edifice, but subterranean tombs. Subterranean grandeur, we can say. Large, cavernous, winding tombs that you would never know were there, and never know how large they are from the outside, buried into the ground. The normal tomb in the New Kingdom, you have about a dozen or so steps going down, leading to a chamber, which leads to a hallway, which leads to another chamber, which typically branches off 90 degrees to the left or the right, and then another 90 degrees from there. But think of it as having these sort of sprawling, maze-like tomb complexes beneath the ground. Every bit as expensive, and every bit as impressive as a pyramid, but just a different perception of what that wealth really should look like. Changing cultural values. It's been over 1,000 years. Ideas and beliefs change all the time. So this is the world that Tutankhamun, whoever he may have been, certainly was born into. Not an age of pyramids, but sprawling subterranean temple complexes. And it's what draws men like Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon to Egypt, because it's very easy to discover a pyramid. It's much more difficult to discover these underground mortuary complexes, because in many cases, you just can't see them. Now, fortunately for the archaeologist at the turn of the century, most of these funerary structures are buried in relatively tight quarters in the same place, in a place we call the Valley of the Kings. Now, the Valley of the Kings is home to dozens and dozens and dozens of funerary complexes of subterranean burial sites. But it sits in a valley just west of the city of Thebes, sometimes called the city of Luxor, the real heart of the ancient Egyptian world. When a king dies, he's buried there. And all through the later part of the 19th century, that's, again, our 19th century, Carnarvon's 19th century, Howard Carter's 19th century, it seems like every month, another tomb complex is being discovered. The sands of the Sahara Desert are blowing, revealing its secrets. Now, Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon could never have gone anywhere near the Valley of the Kings before they met, because the person who had what we'd call the commission to it was another man very similar to Lord Carnarvon, a very wealthy man, a very ambitious man, who really had a blank check and free rein to do any excavations he wanted in the Valley of the Kings. He made modest discoveries. Certainly, the great archaeological discoveries of that area came from him. But right around, again, 1902, 1903, all the way to 1907, the well was running dry. And the commission was going to be up. Carnarvon and Carter desperately wanted to get into that valley and see what they could find. Carnarvon hires Carter, and the game is on. For much of the first decade of the 20th century, Carter and Carnarvon, these two unlikely allies, Carnarvon being the money man, Carter being the guy that gets his hands dirty, have some very interesting successes in the Valley of the Kings. But modern politics and modern circumstances will come into play, because in 1914, World War I breaks out in Europe, and the Western world is changed forever. Britain, Germany, France, Italy, the United States, all parts of the European continent are torn to pieces by World War I. It's a much bigger story than we have time to do it justice. But when the war ends, the world is a fundamentally different place. Not only is Europe devastated and destroyed, but the power of Europe has entirely shifted into the hands of the British Empire, of the victorious parties of World War I. The old enemies of Britain, Germany, are devastated. New opportunities emerge for a lot of people who had no opportunities otherwise. World War I fundamentally changes this planet, changes the way politics are dealt with, changes the way diplomacy is dealt with. People are experiencing major shifts as the Old World and the New World are beginning to come to pass. Egypt is no different. But after World War I, Carnarvon and Carter in 1920 and 1921 really begin to break some new ground in the Valley of the Kings. Now, something has always intrigued Carter, and this is an important step for us as an archaeologist, and for Carnarvon as someone who is more interested in the spectacular finds than necessarily in the small details. He never really saw the attraction. But it was this. Previous to Carter's arrival in the Valley of the Kings to do his work, and really he was the only game in town at that point, the previous archaeologist had found strange old artifacts referencing the name of a pharaoh that no one had ever heard of before, a pharaoh named Tutankhamun, the name literally translating into the living representation of Amun, Tutankhamun. It was a king that was nowhere on record in the modern age. No one was familiar with this, but they certainly found some artifacts claiming he was there. Although that original archaeologist didn't find it, for Carter, that was his ticket. If he could find and discover who this ancient Egyptian pharaoh was, this mysterious king that was yet unknown to the world at the time, that would be his lasting legacy to the field that he loved so much. The items that had really drove Carter to the point where he was to almost certainty that the tomb was still in the Valley of the Kings, despite a mountain of evidence and years of excavation, were fairly mundane items in the modern sense. There was a cup, there was a piece of gold foil, and there was another number of loose items, all of which were not overwhelmingly impressive to Lord Carnarvon, but that were very telling to Carter himself, because they all carried the name of that unknown pharaoh, Tutankhamun. But the question was, where could the body be? Where could the tomb be? Is it possible that there was a tomb in the Valley of the Kings that was yet undiscovered that could perhaps give us an entirely new view on a time period that we knew comparatively little about? Well, after 5 years of digging, what Carter had was reasonably impressive. He had found the tomb of Rameses VI. He had found a number of jars seemingly belonging to the tomb of Merenepta. But what he really wanted, what he really desperately sought, answers to this figure, Tutankhamun, still evaded him. He looked at the landscape, he looked all around it, and he saw nowhere else that could have potentially hidden an entire tomb. But he kept being drawn back to the area of Ramses VI's burial site. Because, again, thinking as an archaeologist, there may be more beneath the soil. Now, all around Ramses' tombs, what he had found was a number of workmen's huts constructed, fairly common at the time. These tombs were massive public building projects. You needed a lot of workers working almost around the clock. So the presence of those buildings weren't necessarily surprising. But one of the things we have to remember about not just archaeology, but all of history, is that we aren't in a constant and perpetual race against the ancient world. There's still progress being made, there's still things being buried today. And the same was true for Carter. Just because those later workers' huts were there, didn't necessarily mean there was nothing underneath them. Well, at this point, the well was beginning to run dry. It was 1922. Lord Carnarvon had just not seen the results he wanted. But Carter, using a careful strategy, mapped out the entire Valley of the Kings, and he looked for the areas that were underexplored compared to some of the more popular sites, and he found a small triangular piece of land that he believed, if King Tutankhamun's tomb existed, it would be there. It was a long struggle, I'm sure it was a heated debate, but he was able to convince Carnarvon to fund his dig for one more chance. Well, sure enough, in November of 1922, Howard Carter hit pay dirt. We mentioned the tomb of Ramses VI that Carter discovered, one of his many discoveries. Nothing, though, that was considered transformative. Because you have to understand the state of tombs and exploring tombs in the early 20th century. One of the realities of exploring the Egyptian world that all archaeologists have to face is that to find a tomb in the situation it was left when it was constructed is nearly impossible. And in fact, Until Howard Carter, it was just deemed to be a fact of life. If you find a tomb, it's going to be empty. Grave robbers descended on tombs seemingly the day they were built. It was a constant struggle. In our world today, thieves and scoundrels operate in all sorts of places at all sorts of times. It has nothing to do with skin color, ethnic background, geography. You just have people who want to take from others to have as their own. It's a fact of human nature. Well, the same was true in ancient Egypt as well. When you find a tomb, it's always going to be empty, and your job is really to sift through what's left behind, really not valuable. People raided these tombs and sold them on the black market centuries before. Well, the Valley of the Kings was no different. Now, because of this, various pharaohs would have what we think of as curses or warnings inscribed on their tombs. Things saying like, if you enter this tomb, you'll be eaten by the crocodile, the hippopotamus, and the lion. I mean, very unusual warnings, but that would make a lot of practical sense in the age. Where Carter knew to find a tomb was to find something that had been pillaged and raided years before. If you could find a tomb that was untouched, though, that is absolutely unheard of at the time. Well, it's from that vein of thinking that Carter really starts to get excited. Because based on the artifacts that he had in his possession, he knew that there was a yet undiscovered king in an undiscovered tomb buried somewhere in the valley he'd worked in for years, for the better part of a decade at that point. He couldn't let it pass by. Carter's brilliance came when he told his workers, dig beneath the workmen's quarters outside of Ramses VI funerary site and see what's there. And sure enough, as they did it, what began to emerge shocked Carter and his team. Because what he saw was something he had only dreamed of. He saw the appearance of steps. Steps that led not up, but down. And steps that had been buried in sand, seemingly, for generations. Had he found Tutankhamun's tomb? Had he found the sealed treasure he had been looking for? He instantly stopped work. He wired Lord Carnarvon back in England, and he told him, the discovery's been made. We will halt all further progress until you arrive. Now, imagine Carter here. He's found the discovery potentially of a lifetime. He's been looking for it for years. It's what he's dreamed of. It's what's kept him awake at night. And he has to halt all progress until his primary benefactor, the wealthy Lord Carnarvon, can arrive. Welcome to the realities of archaeology. But Carnarvon will arrive a few days later, and they'll begin their dig. Carter will dig out the stairs that led down to this yet unknown tomb, and what he sees is exactly what he has in mind. He finds a sealed entryway. Now, a sealed entryway is something that has to be thrilling for the archaeologist, because every other tomb, when it's discovered, has been pillaged and plundered and raided thousands of years earlier. Usually these tombs are filled with debris from floods and natural disasters of all kinds. You're talking about thousands of years of being an open tomb. But not this time. The tomb with the name of the pharaoh Tutankhamun was staring Carter in the face. It was an unopened tomb, undisturbed since antiquity, exactly what Carter had hoped for. Now the real work was set to begin. As Carnarvon was arriving, Carter and his men, to clarify what they were doing, cleared out that long descending staircase, and they quickly approached that sealed tomb. This was not a privilege of the workmen themselves. Whenever that door would be opened, two people would be there. One is the archaeologist Carter, and two was the money man, Lord Carnarvon. It's at this time that we get one of the great stories in all of archaeology, as Howard Carter chipped away at the sealed door in front of him. As he did it, in the hot, sweltering desert sun, Carnarvon was at his side. Both of them had been waiting for this for years. Carter chipped away at the door. He took a candle in his hand, and he slipped it into the opening that he made. The rest of the story can only be best understood in Howard Carter's own words. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner. Darkness and blank space, as far as an iron testing rod could reach, showed that whatever lay beyond was empty and not filled like the passage we had just cleared. Candle tests were applied as a precaution against possible foul gases, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. Lord Carnarvon, standing anxiously beside me to hear the verdict. At first, I could see nothing, the hot air escaping from the chamber causing the candle flame to flicker, but presently, as my eyes grew accustomed to the light, details of the room emerged slowly from the mist. Strange animals, statues, and gold. Everywhere, the glint of gold. From this moment, an eternity it must have seemed for the others standing by, I was struck dumb with amazement when Lord Carnarvon, unable to stand the suspense any longer, inquired anxiously, "Can you see anything?" It was all I could do to get out the words, "Yes, wonderful things. Wonderful things. Wonderful things." That's all the experienced Howard Carter could say. He was dumbfounded at what was before him. What he saw, slipping that candle into that opening, was the first intact tomb ever discovered in Egypt in the history of archaeology. And even better, it was a tomb of a person that we never even knew existed. All archaeologists in the world, on day one, Archaeology 101, hear that story. Wonderful things, perhaps the two most famous words in the history of archaeology. But when Carter looked in, what he saw was a collection of goods, seemingly in a sealed time capsule from the year 1333 BCE. He saw chariots, he saw chairs, he saw thrones, he saw games, he saw statues, he saw weapons, and all across the walls of this chamber, he saw a rich and glorious collection of hieroglyphs explaining the story of the person who was buried inside. His great unknown king, what would become the greatest discovery in the history of archaeology, and still stands to this day as the discovery that changed the world, was made at that moment in November of 1922. Now, the artifacts inside are overwhelmingly beautiful for a number of different reasons. Most importantly was they were made for a king. All of them were made of gold. All of them included jewels, various polished stones, all of the finest treasures of the ancient world. What you were looking at was the physical remains of ancient Egypt, the New Kingdom, at its height. And it was an amazing find. Now, I had the opportunity, not to take too much of an aside from this great dramatic performance, to see the contents of Tutankhamun's tomb firsthand. And when you see them, of course, your general experience with them is through images. I mean, I had seen images of Tutankhamun's tomb for years. But to actually see the contents of this, to see the shimmering gold, to see the beauty, to think that they are in basically the same condition they were the day they were made, you would never think they were from the year 1333 BCE. It really takes your breath away. You can't grasp the amount of time that's passed from when they were made to when you see them, because they look like they were made just yesterday. But it was a collection of goods yet unseen anywhere else in the history of studying ancient Egypt. And Carter would, with Carnarvon's, of course, presence never too far away, little by little, take these goods, take these artifacts out of the chamber he found, categorize them, and classify them. Now, there was nothing fast about this process. You have to understand that. Archaeology is a very slow-moving affair, because you have to categorize, you have to classify, you have to know where everything was situated, because it all tells a story. And very quickly, the goods were removed. You're seeing weeks go by of nothing but classification of goods. Very must be maddening for Carter to consume all of this new material. And of course, Carnarvon's very excited. But as they continuously clean out the tomb, there's something clearly missing from within. And it's what everyone is looking for. It's the great find itself. The king's body is not there. Now, that's not unusual in the history of ancient Egypt. Remember, I said, almost every single tomb before that one was cleaned out by robbers and raiders within years of their original sealing. Well, believe it or not, one of the prized possessions of every tomb is the actual physical remains of the pharaoh themselves. So when you take all the gold and you take all the jewelry, yes, you steal the king's body as well. It's just part of the deal. You're never going to find it. Well, Carter, to the right-hand side of the tomb, found yet another sealed entry. And that sealed entry, he knew, could only possibly contain one thing. And that one thing was the body of the king. Weeks go by, the announcement goes out, the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun makes that young king the most famous pharaoh in history, and a word and a story on everyone's mind on the planet. What's in this tomb? Is the body there? Carter and Carnarvon knew it was. That was November of 1922. We're going to skip ahead now to February of 1923, when they officially open the burial chamber that contained the body of Tutankhamun. Now remember, that's a long span of time. You're talking about 4 months. But again, welcome to archaeology. Very slow moving process. The affair was enormous. There were wealthy debutantes from all around Britain, all around Egypt, in the antechamber that was originally filled with gold and treasures to see the removal of the king's body. Howard Carter opened the burial chamber, and inside sat a massive stone sarcophagus. Now, this sarcophagus was not unlike Russian nesting dolls, if you've ever seen them. You take off one layer, and there's a smaller sarcophagus within. You take off another layer, and there's another sarcophagus within. And with every layer you take away, they were brilliantly adorned with inscriptions and stories about the king's life, layer after layer, 6 layers in all, until the discovery of Tutankhamun's solid gold sarcophagus was made. It was everything that the travelers who came so far to see the unveiling of this mysterious king wanted to see, more than their wildest imaginations could ever produce. A solid gold sarcophagus. Well, sure enough, the king's body was within. And from that moment on, Tutankhamun became the most famous pharaoh in the history of the ancient world. What's unique for us, however, is what we alluded to earlier in the podcast. Tutankhamun is much more famous in death than in life, because Howard Carter had a serious problem ahead of him. And the problem was this: we have the king, we have the most complete tomb ever discovered, and we have the single greatest find in the history of archaeology, but we know almost nothing about the man buried inside the box. We have Tutankhamun, but who was he, and what did he do? Tutankhamun's an interesting figure, because we debate how he dies and we debate what he did in life. But here's what we can say about him based on what we already know. If you remember in the last episode of Wartime, we talked about the very controversial reformer, some will call heretical reformer, Akhenaten, the, perhaps you can say, pharaoh formerly known as Amenhotep IV. But if you recall, Akhenaten completely changed the game for ancient Egypt. He changed how they worship. He even changed what god they worship. He forcibly made Egypt monotheistic, eliminating from the highest pedestal Amun-Ra, and replacing him with a minor god of his choice, the Aten. Well, we talked about already the son, potentially, of Akhenaten was born Tutankhaten. That was very likely Tutankhamun. Now, we don't know that Akhenaten was his father for certain, but Tutankhamun was definitely next in line. Here's what we can put together. We know very little about the reign of Tutankhamun. We just don't know. And we hadn't even known he existed until Carter discovered his tomb in 1922. But now, after reading the inside of the tomb, the stories there, we have a much better sense of who Tutankhamun really was. If you follow the stories within the tomb, we are told this: Tutankhamun was an avid hunter. Tutankhamun loved chariots. He loved riding them. He loved racing them. He was an expert bowsman. And interestingly enough, he probably became pharaoh when he was only 9 years old. At his death, he was probably 19 at the most, certainly over 18. But other than that, we don't know much. We do know, however, that probably in the 3rd year in his reign, early in his reign, Tutankhamun did everything he could to undo the reforms of Akhenaten. He reinstated Amun-Ra as the primary deity. He changed his name from Tutankhaten, that is, the living representation of Aten, to Tutankhamun, the living representation of Amun. And even more drastic, he completely abandoned Akhenaten's brand new capital city of Akhetaten and moved all of the power back to Luxor, to Thebes, the original capital of Egypt before the arrival of Amenhotep IV to become Akhenaten. He not only moved the capital, he rebuilt tombs to Amun-Ra that was destroyed by Akhenaten. He was a reformer in his own right, but he was a reformer that, we can say, put Egypt back on the original course that it was before his predecessor disrupted things in his own way. Again, we discussed that in great detail in a previous episode of Wartime. But now you have the 19-year-old Tutankhamun, and you have him, curiously enough, dead. Now, if you're a pharaoh, you hope to live a long life. You hope to live until you're 70, 80, 90 years old. But Tutankhamun was 19. He was known as the Boy King in newspapers in 1922. So how did he get there? Well, there is always a great debate about how and why Tutankhamun died. And the general story we found based on x-rays taken in the 1960s was that he seemed to have an extensive amount of damage on the bottom left-hand side of the back of his skull. And the story always was he was probably assassinated. That's probably what killed Tutankhamun. Again, we don't know much of his life based on the historical sources, so we have to maybe build it forensically using modern technology. And from about 1965 all the way to about 2005, the story on Tutankhamun was that he was killed by an assassin. Of course, not uncommon. We've talked about this in great detail. Someone probably wanted him out of the way so someone else could come to power. Someone else could usurp his authority. But in 2005, Tutankhamun, who remained in his tomb from 1922 onwards, at the behest, at the request of Howard Carter, was given a modern CT scan. And what they found was that the damage to his skull was so minimal and so precise, it was probably done by the people who mummified him after his death. But, interestingly enough, the king's left leg seemed to have suffered some kind of catastrophic damage. His left femur was broken just above the kneecap. On his right leg, the kneecap was gone altogether. So what we see is that Boy King Tutankhamun probably suffered some sort of disastrous accident. Even more than that, his chest cavity was completely crushed. Now, why was his body in such bad condition? Well, before the CT scan, a lot of people had trouble discerning what happened before he died and what happened post-mortem. Even more than that, and this is deeply troubling, when Howard Carter was exhuming the body from the tomb, the original embalmers who mummified Tutankhamun poured a thick resin all over his body before the tomb was sealed. It had basically glued him to the bottom of the sarcophagus. So Howard Carter had his associates actually dissect the king, taking a sharp knife and cutting him into pieces to remove his mummy from the tomb. Very brutal, very upsetting stuff. But the modern CT scan, modern science, has shed some pretty interesting light on Tutankhamun. And the cause of death is basically this. He was probably in a chariot accident. He probably fell off of a chariot. Judging by the artwork inside of his tomb, the information there, he loved to ride. He broke his leg, so much so that the fracture burst through the skin. He caught an infection and he died. It was probably just that simple. Tutankhamun's tomb does also give us some clues in his death. And the clues are basically this. As far as kings go, from the very famous to the very minor, these sprawling subterranean complexes are enormous. Enormously extensive, enormously vast. Some are so big that even after they were fully excavated, new sealed doorways were found that extended the tombs even further. Tutankhamun's chamber was very small comparatively. You had an antechamber, and you had a burial chamber and a few additional small rooms. All of that indicates that the king died suddenly, and the king died surprisingly. But Tutankhamun in life, is he a typical New Kingdom pharaoh? No. Was he an extraordinary New Kingdom pharaoh, though? Well, he did undo the acts of his predecessor, but otherwise he died so quickly he really didn't have the chance to make his mark the way that other peoples would. Tutankhamun, however, remains one of the most famous pharaohs of all time. And it had nothing to do, curiously enough, with his accomplishments in life. It was the circumstances of his death. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.